From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today, Howard Dean formally announced his candidacy for president at a rally in Burlington, Vermont.
You have the power to take the White House back in 2004, and that is exactly what we're going to be doing. You have that power. You have the power. You have the power. You have the power to take this country back.
Howard Dean's unapologetic left-of-center anti-war message has been a rallying cry for fed-up liberals across the country ready for some new old-time Democratic fire and brimstone, but he is drawing the ire of centrist new Democrats who call him an unelectable candidate for the White House in new George McGovern. Tonight on Point, the irrepressible Howard Dean, savior or spoiler for the Democrats in 2004. We begin with a looming online primary. This week, the 1.4 million member internet-based group MoveOn.org will hold its own Democratic primary vote. Just as television once changed the way campaigns were run, the internet may now be having its effect as a cheap and effective way to organize. Ronald Brownstein has been covering the evolution of online politics for the Los Angeles Times. Earlier, I asked him to describe MoveOn.org and its upcoming internet primary.
MoveOn.org is a new age online liberal advocacy group that was founded originally to resist the impeachment of President Clinton and has since found a kind of second life as a voice of those Democrats who want, or those activists really, who want the Democratic Party to take a more aggressive posture in opposing President Bush, particularly on foreign policy. They now have a claim 1.4 million members online who have proven themselves very active in enlisting in the group's causes, both in contributing money to Democratic candidates in 2000 and 2002, writing letters. They generated over 200,000 letters to the Federal Communication Commission opposing the recent decision allowing media conglomerates to own more properties, and they have shown themselves, as I say, to be a very active core group. Now, what they're doing is trying to mobilize this group behind one of the Democratic presidential candidates, and starting tonight at midnight and running through Wednesday night at 11:59, they're going to be holding a vote among their members, which amounts to the first primary in the Democratic contest.
So they're plunging into a kind of online primary. How will the primary work? How will people vote, and what exactly are they looking for?
Essentially, they will vote online. People can register up until, as I understand it, midnight tonight to participate in the primary, so it's not open only to those who are already existing members of the group. And in fact, Tom, all of the Democratic presidential candidates have been encouraging their supporters to register and participate in this. The rules are that someone has to get to 50% in order to win this group's nomination. And, you know, if you look at their track record, there is reason to believe it could be a nomination or an endorsement worth winning. As I say, they have shown a propensity to contribute in the past, and if someone can get to that 50% threshold and win this endorsement, it may be worth a significant amount in terms of contributions, not only now, but down the road, because the beauty of an online organization is it is essentially, you know, the cost of communicating with them is minimal, essentially maintaining your website, as opposed to going out in direct mail, as, say, Gary Hart had to do after he won the New Hampshire primary in 1984. If someone wins this endorsement in these next couple days and then turns around and wins the New Hampshire primary next January, they could leverage a lot of money out of this list potentially in a very short period of time.
Now, let's try and put this in perspective. MoveOn.org, as you say, at this point, about 1.4 million members. How does that compare with the number of voters who turn out in Iowa and New Hampshire for primaries?
Well, infinitely more. I mean, I think that if you if you look at the history, probably about 150,000 people or so will vote in New Hampshire, and maybe 100,000 at most in Iowa. In 2000, there was only 60,000 people participated in the Democratic caucus. I don't think anybody assumes that all 1.4 million members will vote in this online caucus or online primary, but it's conceivable they could have significantly more voters than participate in those two primaries. Now, this isn't exactly a cross-section of Democratic opinion. I mean, this is a group that leans strongly to the left, as reflected by the fact that when they held a straw poll in May to sort of assess, sort of a first cut at what their members thought, the top three finishers were Howard Dean, Dennis Kucinich, and John Kerry, although they won't reveal the order. And, of course, the first two are outright opponents of the war in Iraq, and Kerry was the most skeptical of the other remaining major candidates. So it's not as though this is an early indication of who has the broadest appeal in the Democratic primary, but it could be one important asset for someone who wins the – if someone can win the endorsement. By the way, they have said that if no one gets the 50%, they will hold more primaries down the road until someone does.
Now, of course, Ron Brownstein, American presidential politics are ultimately state-based and electoral college-based.
Right.
So how are people interpreting the meaning of a national online constituency that is self-selected and kind of left-leaning to begin with? How important is this? What does it tell us about where politics may be going in their relationship with the Internet?
A lot of good questions there. Well, first of all, in the immediate effect on this race, I think this will be important more for its practical value to the winner, if there is one.
That is cash value.
That is the cash, and also in, volunteers and names of people who they can enlist in various states. It'll be more important in that way than as a symbol of broader strength. I mean, you do have the problem that it is a self-selected group that does lean left, and in that sense is not representative of the broader Democratic Party, per se. They've also raised some questions about the validity of the process because they allowed Dean, Kerry, and Kucinich as those top three finishers from May to email directly to the 1.4 million members. Everyone else, all the other candidates, you can find out about them by going to the website, and there are links in the email. But they allowed those three, I think, a little bit of a thumb on the scale. And you've already had Dick Gephardt complaining, his campaign, that the process was rigged, in their words, because of that advantage that they're providing. So I'm not sure it will be seen as a broader symbol of where people are overall, but I do think that if Dean, who is given by far the best chance of getting to that 50% threshold, if he does win, it would be another sign of momentum and a sign of him consolidating to some extent the left behind his candidacy, rather remarkably, as you know, largely a centrist governor of Vermont, emerging as potentially the principal or the dominant candidate of the left in this race.
So, Ron, what are people thinking in political circles about the onward impact of this kind of internet constituency? If this emerges as a significant factor in the early days here of this presidential election, at least in the Democratic Party, are people expecting that there will be more internet constituencies influencing elections in years ahead?
I think so. I mean, if you look at this as a progression from what happened 4 years ago when John McCain had a certain amount of success at raising funds over the internet and organizing support, Dean has taken it a step further. He's used this meetup.com website to organize meetings of his supporters around the country, and they claim to have acquired 33,000 names through that process. If this group's endorsement proves valuable in material terms, if in fact it can generate money, if it can generate volunteers, if it can generate other campaign activity, I think you will see emulations of this by other interests in 2008. Wes Boyd, who is the founder of a computer software magnate who founded this with his wife in 1998, you know, he says, look, he expects to see dozens of groups like this by 2008 because, of course, it is so much less expensive to attract supporters if the supporters, in effect, find you. One of the great hurdles for any advocacy group is the cost of going out through direct mail and advertising and finding the people who agree with you. The internet, the technology, reverses the process. The supporters find you. It's essentially free, except for the cost of maintaining the website and a small staff. They have six people who work for this organization, and they are able to raise millions of dollars for their candidates. They are able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to fund ads attacking Bush on the war in Iraq, for instance. And if this can then translate into a presidential endorsement that has some material value, you've got to think that other people are going to sort of move to this mousetrap.
Ron, is there currently a right-wing or GOP counterpart to MoveOn.org?
I'm not aware of anything on this scale in either party that compares to this or that has been able to raise money at this level. I mean, they clearly have created a community. You know, they have found a group of people with similar views who feel they're not being represented through other means and who feel passionately enough about this cause to pour out the emails and the contributions when they ask for it.
Ron Brownstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ron Brownstein is national political correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. As he formally announced his candidacy today as Democratic presidential hopeful, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean vowed to bring the Democratic Party back to its liberal roots.
I believe that by running for president, that I could raise the issues of health care for every American, And I wanted to balance the budget to bring fiscal stability and jobs back to the United States of America. But most importantly, I wanted my party to stand up for what we believe again.
Howard Dean has tapped a vein of Democratic longing for an uncompromising attack from the left on the Bush White House. But not all Democrats are cheering for candidate Dean. Centrist New Democrats call him a divisive and unrealistic nominee, a self-indulgent candidate who ignores the winning legacy of the Clinton White House years. In recent history, they say, it is the moderate third way that has won elections for the Democrats, while left-wing politics have fallen short again and again. Where are you in the Howard Dean debate? Do you buy the Dean message? Do you believe it helps or hurts the Democratic cause? Is the Dean line on America a wake-up call for Democrats or Democratic self-destruction? Is Dr. Dean a savior or a spoiler for the Democrats in 2004? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Matt Bai, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He wrote about Howard Dean and the Democrats in an article in the June 1st issue of the magazine, Dr. No and the Yes Men. Good evening and great to talk with you, Matt Bai.
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you again.
It's good to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Also joining us from Washington is Eleanor Clift, a contributing editor with Newsweek magazine. Eleanor, thanks for being with us. Welcome
great
back.
Great to be with you. Hi.
It's great to have you. Matt Bai, so you kind of laid all of this out in a picture of some real fear and loathing in the Democratic Party of Dr. Howard Dean. Why does he have the other candidates in the Democratic lineup in such a lather?
Well, as Dean has tapped into a very powerful emotion among the Democratic base, and when I say base, I mean the activists who tend to be more liberal, who can decide the fate of the early primaries disproportionately. And Dean understood, I think mostly as a result of his anti-war stance and the way it was received, that there was a great deal of rage and frustration in the liberal ranks at the way the party had behaved, not just recently, but throughout the Clinton years. There's a feeling that the party's true message, its soul, has been sold out. And by sort of exploiting that and really playing to it quite baldly, I think, in the last several months, Dean has widened this chasm within the party and, in effect, has framed the race as a race between what he calls the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party and a bunch of guys who only care about getting elected. And that threatens to sow such disunity among the Democratic ranks that at the end of the day, regardless of who gets the nomination, it could be a serious impediment in taking on a very powerful and popular president.
So there's the Dean strategy and the Dean problem, I guess, from a certain perspective. How upset, from your reporting, Matt Bai, do you find the non-Dean Democratic establishment, the non-Dean campaigns?
Increasingly upset. You know, there were months where just after the war vote and the march into war, where it was kind of quiet and under the surface, and you would talk to centrist Democrats and Washington establishment Democrats, and they would sort of say, well, I don't really like what Dean is doing, but, you know, he was a good governor, and he was centrist as a governor, and there would be sort of sniping or off-the-record sort of backhanded comments, and it just increasingly burst out into the open in the Democratic Leadership Council, which is really the standard bearer for centrist Democrats and which launched the Clinton presidency, has been the most vocal in saying not only is Dean the wrong candidate for the party, but he's leading the party down the wrong path.
Eleanor Clift, what do you think? How big an issue? How serious an issue? How do you interpret the old-time religion that Dean is working here?
Well, I think Dean, in traveling around the country, has found that Democrats are almost as angry at Democrats as they are at the Republican Party. I think I agree with Matt that there's some of that is longstanding frustration that Clinton moved the party too much to the center, but I really think it's more about an inability to stand up to George Bush and the after effects of last year's election. I think the centrist Democrats, who were seen as behind the strategy in 2002, didn't get the Democrats any seats in the House or Senate and put them further behind. And so I think the centrist Democrats right now, in the minds of activists around the country, have been discredited. But this is a perennial argument within the Democratic Party. How far left do you go to excite the base, or how far to the middle do you go to try to pick up the swing voters? And I think Dean is running a classic insurgent campaign against the Washington establishment.
And
the establishment is rallying around themselves and trying to keep him out.
Ready to push back. We're talking tonight about the Dean factor. Howard Dean as savior or spoiler for the Democrats in 2004. You can join us. Did you hear Howard Dean formally declared today for the presidency? Are you caught up in Dean fever? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Howard Dean factor in the 2004 presidential elections and the fight for the soul of the Democratic Party. My guests are Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek, and Matt Bai, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. You can join the conversation as well. Do you want a Democratic candidate who's angry and liberal and proud of it, or centrist and gunning for the American mainstream? Do the Democrats need to get old-time religion or stick with Bill Clinton's centrist third way? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Today, Howard Dean formally announced his intention to run for the White House at a rally in Burlington, Vermont, and reaffirmed the anti-war stance that has pitted him against the Bush administration on war in Iraq and global U.S. strategy.
Since the time of Thomas Paine and John Adams, our founders have implored that we are not to be the new Rome. We are not to conquer and suppress other nations to submit to our will. We are to inspire them. America is far stronger as the moral and military leader of the world than we will ever be relying solely on military power. Every American president must and will take up arms in the defense of our nation. It is a solemn oath that cannot and that will not be compromised. But there is a fundamental difference between the defense of our nation and the doctrine of preemptive war espoused by this administration.
Howard Dean earlier today in Burlington, Vermont. We're talking tonight about the Dean factor. Howard Dean is savior or spoiler for the Democrats in 2004. Joined by Matt Bai from the New York Times, Eleanor Clift from Newsweek, and right now by Will Marshall joining us from Washington. He is president of the Progressive Policy Institute, a think tank affiliated with the centrist Democratic Leadership Council. He helped found the DLC in 1985. Good evening and welcome, Will Marshall.
Good evening.
Will Marshall, you wrote in May, as the war in Iraq was wrapping up and the outcome looked swift and satisfactory to the White House anyway, that outcome dealt a near fatal blow to the presidential prospects of Howard Dean, whose staunch opposition to the war, you wrote, thrilled Iowa's left-leaning activists but is out of step with rank-and-file Democrats. Here we are a couple of months later. Do you see Howard Dean walking around with a fatal blow to his prospects?
Well, I wouldn't change that judgment very much. After all, one of the biggest vulnerabilities that Democrats are going to carry into a general election against George Bush is a reputation for weakness on national security, which is only the most important issue, according to Americans, in this post-11 era. So I argued then, and I really don't see any reason to change my mind, that it would be foolish for the party, if it actually wants to beat George Bush, to put up a candidate who's most likely to remind people of their doubts about the Democratic Party and to play right directly to George Bush's strengths as a commander-in-chief and a representative of a party that enjoys 30 and 40-point advantages on questions of national toughness, willingness to face down our enemies and act resolutely in the face of external threats.
And yet the Dean candidacy has not gone away, his formal announcement today. How do you see it affecting the Democratic field overall? Is it helping stir people up and get them in the fray, or is it dividing? Is it forcing the other candidates to lean left and be less electable next fall?
Well, I think it's a good thing that he's out there. I'm not sure Democrats need much stirring up. There is a lot of anger that runs across the spectrum, left to center, toward this president. And I don't have any problem with Howard Dean going out there and making his case. although I would quibble with the way he does it. For example, he seems to have gotten a lot of traction by attacking not George Bush, but his fellow Democrats. They are, to put not too fine a point on it, in his account anyway, cowards. They're afraid to stand up to George Bush and all this sort of stuff. And he urges Democrats to he tells them that he's a Democrat. He comes from the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. The canard here is a very familiar one to us, is that if you aren't a liberal, if you aren't on the left, then you're somehow not a genuine Democrat and you're somehow cowardly. Well, we don't agree, and we've had the temerity to disagree with the governor.
Listeners, what do you think about the Dean factor? Do you have Dean fever? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Glenn is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi. Sorry about that. I'm in my car right now.
We got you loud and clear.
Actually, I'm on my way to a Dean rally right now to listen to the recorded announcement of his speech with a batch of other people here in Milwaukee.
So you're a Dean fan. Why? Why, Glenn?
Why? Because, as Dean says, I'm sick and tired of the Democratic Party being taken over by crossover Republican conservatives and pretending that being a me Bush also is going to get them elected. If they want to vote Republican, they're going to vote Republican. There's no reason to vote for a Republican under a Democratic name. We have to have a true Democrat. We have the best chance by electing a governor who has not been voting in Congress and Senate for the Bush agenda. We have our best chance by finding somebody like the last time when Bush Sr. was at a 90% after his war popularity in the polls, where Bush never where Bush Jr. never reached more than 70.
But Glenn, Bill Clinton won with a centrist, a markedly centrist approach. Howard Dean's not taking that approach.
It might have been centrist relative to the time. Right now, the people that will vote Democrat, along with the independents that are wondering what they're going to do, like a lot of the Greens that found out their mistake by voting green and thinking a third party might do something last time, and look at what it got us. So
Glenn, you're off to the rally, and good luck to you. Thanks for calling. Matt Bai, you've done some reporting on this. Is that the tenor, the substance of the Democratic voice in favor of Howard Dean that you find out and about?
Very much so. It's not issue-based. In other words, it's not about, you know, I agree with what he says. I like his health care plan because it does X or Y, or I'm for a balanced budget, and he says he balanced the budget in Vermont. I mean, you get a little of that, but by and large, that's exactly it. It's a very emotional appeal about someone who will stand up and be counted. And interestingly, you know, Dean has picked up on something here that I think centrist Democrats and the DLC and the folks who rallied behind President Clinton really need to look at, which is the difference between having a centrist agenda and the difference between having an agenda for electability. And, you know, Bill Clinton had, and the DLC, when he ran in 1992, had a very revolutionary, really, agenda, not just centrist for the purpose of getting elected, but a lot of innovative ideas to change the way the Democratic Party actually looked at a lot of issues and attacked problems with different solutions. There has been a greater and greater emphasis on how to win campaigns, on how to get elected. It seems as though centrist Democrats are always saying what they need to say and not what they feel. And what you're seeing now is a real backlash against that. And whether or not Dean is successful, it's a problem that centrist Democrats have to look at and have to figure out how to address.
Eleanor Clift, how about it? Senator Bob Graham, also a candidate, of course, says he is from the electable wing of the Democratic Party. But the Dean folks accuse a lot of the other Democratic candidates of being Me Too candidates. Is that centrist Me Too-ism a winning strategy for 2004?
Well, as a minor point, Dean doesn't accuse Senator Graham of that, because Graham voted against the war resolution, and
that's right,
he's
fair enough.
A pretty strong voice on Capitol Hill. Look, George W. Bush is the Bill Clinton in this race. He has very successfully blurred the lines on issues that used to belong to the Democrats. Education and pharmaceutical drugs and health care certainly come to mind. What Dean is doing is he's drawing some very clear lines, but to think of him as a way-out liberal is to totally misread him and to totally ignore his record. He was never a darling of the DLC, but he was a favorite. He balanced the budget.
In Vermont.
Mm-hmm. He did not, go after the gun issue, which a lot of Democrats now think is suicidal to raise that. He won the endorsement of the NRA. His health plan is far more modest than some of the other plans in the race. So I think if he pulls this off, it will be because he can both appeal to the passion on the left, and he can balance it with some governing ideas that are not going to turn off moderates and swing voters who will see him as a far-out liberal. The Republicans are trying to characterize him as a McGovern who's not a war hero, and frankly, the Democrats are doing a pretty good job of helping the Republicans deliver that message. And my first introduction to national campaigns as a reporter was the Jimmy Carter campaign, and I watched the Washington establishment go after Carter because he was too conservative at that time. And, you know, sometimes that fuels the voter base out there. So, you know, the establishment may be doing Dean a favor by looking askance at him as an outsider. It's what the voters would like.
Piling on there. Matt Bai, what about the Jimmy Carter example? Is that one that Howard Dean is following? How is his effort similar, different from Jimmy Carter in the 1976?
Well, it certainly was similar when he started out, in the sense that there were a lot of similarities between the two of them, and that was, you know, talked about quite a bit, that he was a centrist governor, that he was an outsider from Washington, little known, that he was out of office, he was an ex-governor, and therefore could wander around Iowa and New Hampshire pretty much with all his time. You know, he's in retirement, he had plenty of time. And you know, he had a pretty centrist agenda when he talked about balancing the budget and a health care plan built on at least largely on the private sector.
But then came the vote on war and all that followed.
Yeah, and I think the campaign really got away from him, Tom. I mean, I think if truth be told, at the end of the day, Howard Dean, there was no strategy there. I think sometimes in politics, we all sit around divining, you know, inner motives and strategies when, in effect, you know, events just overtake you.
And he spoke out against the war resolution, and he was suddenly inundated with support he had not had.
Exactly. And it changed the nature of the campaign because you take support where you can get it. He also recognized an emotion inside the party that I don't think he had been that in touch with before, and he recognized the power of it to his credit. And I think, you know, to be fair to Dean, I wrote, and I think it upset some Dean supporters, that essentially a lot of his campaign now is about rage and anger, and not so much of it is about lifting up discourse. It's not the lofty liberal crusade, not only because he's not so liberal on the issues, as Eleanor rightly points out, but because it's not all that ennobling. I mean, at the end of the day, most of his speeches are about how cowardly his opponents are. But it's early in the campaign, and I think events got away from Dean a little bit, and I think there's still time for him to redefine himself and define his policies in a more centrist way while also being a candidate with more conviction and more passion.
There it is. Gary's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, I'm a Howard Dean supporter, although I'm not sure that I would support him because I'm looking at some of the other Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
However, what I like about Dean is that he is taking on George Bush and George Bush's policies, which are ripe for criticism, and your DLC spokesman there exposed the DLC for precisely what they are. They are the problem. They are just like Bush when it comes to the military-industrial complex and the war machine. And Gephardt and Lieberman, either one of those guys, if they get the nomination, the center-left part of the Democratic Party will leave the room. The air will go out of the support for the party. The party will not be energized, and they will get creamed.
But Gary, do you think that Howard Dean can scoop up enough of the center to be a winning candidate for the White House?
Absolutely. Not only the center of the Democratic Party, but any American, regardless of party, lots of independent voters don't agree with Bush and his policies. And I think if there's a candidate out there that will expose some of these policies and really bring them to light, I think the Democrats have a great chance. It's not just the center of the Democratic Party, but the center to the left of the Democratic Party will be energized, as well as lots of independents.
Let me put that to Will Marshall. Will, our caller from Madison, says, hey, DLC, Progressive Policy Institute, you are the problem.
Well, I know. We've been hearing this for a long time. I remember the same attack leveled at Bill Clinton before he got elected. He was a crypto-Republican, a Me Too Republican. He was too centrist. He would never energize the base. Look, there's a perennial myth in the Democratic Party. It's sort of, I'm a Southerner, and I'm familiar with the myth of the lost cause in the South, but the lost cause in Democratic politics is for the liberal savior. And if only we got somebody as undiluted, unadulterated, and plain-spoken, then we'll rally the masses. The problem is the old New Deal coalition is history. It's been history since 1980, so we're chasing a chimera here. But look, I want to grant one point, which I think is important that both Matt and Eleanor made, and that is that Howard Dean doesn't begin life as any kind of doctrinaire lefty. On the contrary, he had a very interesting governorship in Vermont, but his campaign has become much less interesting from our point of view. That is, he was eclectic, very hard to pin down as governor. In fact, he was pretty much a moderate. He steered between extremes of left and right. The very thing he now, by the way, accuses us and other Democrats of doing. So I put that down as a bit of hypocrisy that is intended to now convince enraged liberal activists that he's their champion.
Gary, Will Marshall has you following a hypocrite on a pointless exercise.
Well, you know, what I'd like to know, the DLC, in my opinion, don't represent patriotism in this country. I think the DLC is another sham for representing the interests of the elite. And we don't need two parties representing the elite in this country. We need one party that will take on the special interests, the big money, the big corporations, the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, and tell people the truth about what's going on in this country and get back to representing the masses rather than the elite.
Gary, we got it. Thanks for your call. Eleanor Clift, how do you interpret this conversation going on right here? It is a Democratic conversation.
Well, I think the caricaturing of Dean as a liberal stems from his position on the war resolution, but there is plenty of hypocrisy to go around on that war resolution. If that had been a secret vote, a lot of the Democrats who voted for it would not have supported it, and the Democrats in Washington were intimidated by a White House that very successfully implies that you're unpatriotic if you don't support the military action. Dean is not a pacifist. In fact, he said, you know, he would have favored going ahead with military action if it were part of a UN coalition.
Not a pacifist. He said that repeatedly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I think on the whole war issue, we don't know how Iraq is going to look a year from now, and it doesn't look like such a wonderful victory to me, certainly, and I think to a lot of people. And so, you know, Dean, Will Marshall suggested that his position on the war would, in the end, doom him. But, you know, it may, depending on events, it may actually, you know, propel him in the nomination. But I do wonder whether talking about national security issues, you play the game on Bush's field, and he does enjoy an advantage. And the Democrats, if they want to win, have got to get the dialogue, I think, back to domestic issues. And if they tie it into Iraq, maybe it's at the look at what the resources Iraq is taking and what it's costing us at home. I mean, that's probably a promising route, I think.
It could be big. Matt Bye, I know we have to lose you in half a minute. What do you think? Is Howard Dean the kind of candidate who will take another turn here, head back toward the center, or is he now anchored where he got himself after the war resolution?
Well, I think he's in a little bit of a box. I mean, I think what I've sort of noticed is the way that he tries really to hedge in that box. I mean, he's painted himself as a straight talker, but it's gotten harder and harder to be a straight talker because he doesn't want to forfeit support on the left, and he also doesn't want to give up his claim to the center. So that's going to be a really hard balance for him to strike, and I don't think we know quite how he's going to do it yet.
Matt Bye, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good hearing from you.
Sure. Thanks, Tom.
Matt Bye is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. We're talking tonight about the Dean Factor, Howard Dean as savior or spoiler for the Democrats in 2004. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Dean Factor, about Howard Dean as savior or spoiler for the Democrats in 2004. You can join the conversation. Does Dr. Dean have the right prescription for victory next year, or is he the new George McGovern? Should Democrats compete for the middle ground or fire up a two-fisted liberal assault on George Bush? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. 8255. Today, former Governor Howard Dean, Vermont Governor, formally declared his run for the White House in 2004. His message has been unapologetically left of center and focused on returning the Democratic Party to its more liberal populist roots.
The history of our nation is clear. At every turn, when there has been an imbalance of power, the truth questioned or our beliefs and values distorted, the change required to restore our nationhood has always come from the bottom up, from our people. And so while the president raises $4 million more tonight to maintain his agenda, we will not be silent.
Howard Dean announcing his candidacy at a rally today in Burlington, Vermont. John is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening. You're on the air, John.
I just want to say that I feel that there's a McCain kind of component going on in Nashua and in New Hampshire with regard to Governor Dean. People in New Hampshire generally like to, a lot of times in primaries, vote for the outsider, someone who is against the establishment. They want to be a little bit different. That was the McCain factor last time around. And that is most definitely going on in my neighborhood.
Do you feel excitement? Do you feel excitement for Howard Dean there in New Hampshire, John?
Oh, absolutely. There is definitely excitement. I think that if people don't understand that, they really have not keyed in to what's going on, because he's even more exciting than Kerry is right now in the Nashua area.
John, thanks for the report from the front. Eleanor Clift, how do you interpret Howard Dean's momentum right now vis-a-vis the other candidates? How does he look in New Hampshire and Iowa?
Well, I think for a time there he pulled even with Senator Kerry, but I think John Kerry has subsequently come out and taken some stronger stands against President Bush, saying that the president misled us in the lead-up to the war. So I think Kerry is trying to, you know, borrow a page from Dean and sound a little more angry and impassioned as he goes about trying to win votes. But Dean so far is the only one of the Democrats, who has a shot at the nomination, who is really eliciting any kind of visceral response from voters. And I think it's fascinating to watch the other candidates go after him. I mean, Dean himself has been blamed for speaking sort of harshly of the other candidates, but boy, they've returned the fire and in some cases initiated the exchanges, because he's the biggest threat to Dick Gebhardt in Iowa and the biggest threat to John Kerry in New Hampshire, and so they're after him.
And what about the McCain analogy here? Is it accurate, and how does it bode for Howard Dean?
Oh, there's that edginess, that sense that he is blunt and that he may say something that will get him in trouble, but that he's not a scripted candidate, and that's what was appealing about John McCain. But the establishment turned that against John McCain, and I remember the questions being raised about Senator McCain's temperament, and did he have the temperament to be president? And on Meet the Press this Sunday, in an hour-long interview, Tim Russert really grilled Howard Dean.
Had him on the ropes a bit there.
That's right. And at one point asked him whether he thought he had the temperament to be president. And so I thought that was it was kind of early in the process for his personality to become that kind of a negative issue.
Will Marshall, what do you think, given where Howard Dean, given the arc of his campaign so far, can he turn toward what, to your mind, is a winning spot in this campaign?
Well, I thought Matt Bayh hit it on the head. That is, he's in a box of his own devising. And now if he wants to speak to voters outside the enraged liberal core, it becomes very difficult for him. It looks like he is trimming, pulling his punches, or taking positions that are greeted with silence instead of rapturous cheering from the folks whose rage he's now channeling. So frankly, you know, and I disagree with Matt, that this just happened, that things happen in campaign. I think Howard Dean made a very conscious decision. Remember, his campaign was not particularly catching fire before the war. He was out there in Iowa, down in the second tier of candidates, and he rode anger there, focused on the war, but not exclusively centered on it, but that was the spark, and he rode it and right into the first tier of candidates. But as Eleanor has said, at least the polling in New Hampshire shows he's been subsiding, and it's possible that a wave that is, again, kind of propelled by anger and protest may have peaked too early, and that's now receding somewhat. But even if he remains, if his conscious decision is to remain the liberal favorite and the scourge of the centrist or mainstream Democrats, I really don't see how he once again reinvents himself, this time as a candidate who's going to be more appealing to moderate voters, independent voters, the swing voters in American politics who they're open to attacks on George Bush and criticism of him, but they don't viscerally hate him like the people that Howard Dean is really catching on.
I really disagree that this is a candidacy built mostly on rage and among people who can't stand President Bush. I mean, Howard Dean is a medical doctor. He is talking about delivering health care to every American. He gets audiences whooping and hollering and cheering him over the prospect of rebalancing the budget and how that will affect the economy in a positive way. And he is developing a message that says we want to bring all Americans together, that President Bush has divided us in a number of ways.
Not exactly a red scare, rebalancing the budget.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, I think he is a voice of optimism and hope. I don't think he's just appealing to negative emotions at all.
I want to get a call from Mark calling from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
I'm as much an anti-neoconservative as I am a Democrat. And I think that's the sentiment of a lot of us out here. And the thing that the Democratic Party has to do is come to grips with the issues and start fighting. In the midterm elections, everybody just kind of mummed up and never came to grips with the issues and got crushed.
But do you think all the other Democratic candidates look so pussyfooting in this election? Is it really only Howard Dean who's punching?
There are others who are speaking up, but the thing is, the Democratic Party has to really start hammering on the hypocrisy of the neoconservative foundation of the Bush administration.
Mark, our time is running down. Let me take that and put it to Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, here's a quote from California Democrat Zoe Lofgren, representative. She says, everybody is tired of these mealy-mouthed, nuanced, afraid of your own shadow. Who are you candidates? Does Howard Dean's candidacy make all the other candidates somehow look like they fit into that mold?
Well, I mean, I think that's the contrast that he's been drawing and that the media has helped him along with, although I don't think he's the darling of the media by any means. I think a lot of the articles written about him find him too arrogant and think that he is too far left. So I don't think he's a media darling. But look, people in Washington do fall victim to Washington speak. They talk about different legislative proposals. They often have votes on every side of the issue. And the war resolution is classic. I mean, many of the Democrats who voted for that, and I think I'm probably including some of the Democrats who are running, were really ambivalent. But everybody was remembering the first Gulf War and the fact that that turned out to be successful, and they were scared to be on the wrong side of this.
So
now
let's
they're
get on
doing
board.
A little trimming here, and Senator Kerry is foremost among them. Beginning to speak out critically of certainly the aftermath of the war and some of the statements in the lead-up.
Howard Dean may not end up alone. Eleanor Clift,
right.
Will Marshall with that. We're out of time tonight, but I want to thank you both for joining us. Eleanor Clift, contributing editor at Newsweek, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Will Marshall, president of the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a 13-year-old shares her passion for Harry Potter. This is On Point. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, the fifth in J.K. Rowling's series, shattered sales records and ended several weak quarters for the publishing trade this weekend by bringing crowds flooding back to bookstores. The book sold 5 million copies on its first day of release, nearly twice as many as the estimated 12-month sales of last year's best-selling John Grisham novel. 13-year-old Hannah Maurer of Bloomington, Illinois, started reading Harry Potter books 4 years ago as a fourth grader. Like hundreds of thousands of devotees, she reserved her copy in April and picked it up after its release at 12:01 a.m. on Saturday. Hannah stayed up all night to read the first 500 pages. In this radio diary, Hannah shares her passion and some text from the young wizard who has seized the imagination of both children and adults.
I got the book Saturday morning because they were having a problem because they met fire capacity and they were letting, like, some people in, some people out, and the line was all the way back to the cafe in Barnes & Noble, so it took me at least, like, 15 minutes just to get the book. Like, so I got it about 12:30, 12:45. I was so excited to read it, I could barely even think of reading it. I mean, I've been anticipating reading it for so long that it was kind of weird having the book. So when I got home, I got a drink, and then I went upstairs, and I didn't stop reading until like 6 in the morning. I was so happy to have it. I fell asleep accidentally, and then I woke up at 9 and read like for half an hour, and then I slept until about 1. And then I started reading again. In this book, Harry wasn't treated as if he was, like, the best person in the world. He got a ton of detentions, and I think he got kicked off the Quidditch team because they had this awful new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher who was with the ministry, so she kind of kept on giving him detention. So he wasn't treated as a famous person, but kind of normal, almost like people didn't like him, you know, because this year it was kind of bad for him because, you know, he was getting older and he kept on, you know, getting angry at everybody. I'm going to read about how the Dementors attacked him and Dudley. Here it goes. Something had happened to the night. The star-strewn indigo sky was suddenly pitch black and lightless. The stars, the moon, the misty street lamps at either end of the alley had vanished. The distant grumble of cars and the whisper of trees had gone. The balmy evening was suddenly piercingly, bitingly cold. They were surrounded by total, impenetrable, silent darkness, as though some giant hand had dropped a thick, icy mantle over the entire alleyway, blinding them. For a split second, Harry thought he had done magic without meaning to, despite the fact that he had been resisting as hard as he could. Then his reason caught up with his senses. He then had the power to turn off the stars. He turned his head this way and that, trying to see something, but the darkness pressed on his eyes like a weightless veil. Dudley's terrified voice broke in Harry's ears. "Well, what are you doing? Stop it! I'm not doing anything. Shut up and don't move. I can't see. I've gone blind. I said shut up," Harry said, stock still, turning his sightless eyes left and right. The cold was so intense that he was shivering all over. Goosebumps had erupted up his arms, and the hair on the back of his neck was standing up. He opened his eyes to their fullest extent, staring blankly around, unseeing. It was impossible. They couldn't be her. Not in Little Winging. He strained his ears. He would hear them before he saw them. "I'll tell Dad," Dudley whimpered. "Where are you? What are you doing?" "Will you shut up?" Harry hissed. "I'm trying to listen." But he fell silent. He had heard just the thing he had been dreading. There was something in the alleyway apart from themselves. Something that was drawing long, hoarse, rattling breaths. Harry felt a horrible jolt of dread as he stood trembling in the freezing air.
The magic-touched Hannah Maurer is 13 and lives in Bloomington, Illinois. She now has 5 Harry Potter books behind her. She loves horses and would like to be a forensic scientist one day. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.